We recently asked a couple hundred of you emerging biotech leaders about your go-to sources of information when you face tough professional challenges. Your top response wasn't webinars, it wasn't scientific journals, it wasn't trade shows, it wasn't even consultants. Far and away, you said you most often turn to your peers for trusted insight. Enabling a community of peers is what the Business of Biotech podcast is all about. It's also what our new Business of Biotech newsletter is all about. Peer-driven content, no strings attached, delivered to your inbox once a month. Go to bioprocessonline.com/BOB to subscribe. The Business of Biotech is produced by Bioprocess Online, part of the Life Science Connect community, with support from Cytiva. Cytiva also demonstrates its commitment to the leaders of new and emerging biopharma at cytiva.com/emerging biotech. Check that out. In her book, The Signature of All Things, the writer Elizabeth Gilbert says this about moss. Moss grows where nothing else can grow. It grows on bricks. It grows on tree bark and roofing slate. It grows in the Arctic Circle and in the balmiest tropics. It also grows on the fur of sloths, on the backs of snails, on decaying human bones. It is a resurrection engine. A single clump of mosses can lie dormant and dry for 40 years at a stretch and then vault back again into life with a mere soaking of water. Doctors Bjorn Koklovius and Andreas Schaff like moss too. They think it can grow medicine, so they're leveraging Brio technology to use moss as a protein production medium for biopharma applications. The physical and biologic attributes of moss, they say, lends to the reliable production of complex and demanding proteins in a potentially easier and less expensive effort than the traditional CHO cell approach. I'm Matt Piller, and on today's episode of The Business of Biotech, we're going to get to know Drs. Koklovius and Schaff, and we're going to learn about their company, Eleva, and how it's aiming to disrupt the production of therapeutic proteins with moss, beginning with its own enzyme replacement candidates for Fabry and Pompe disease. Bjorn and Andreas, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
Hi, Matt. Pleasure.
Pleasure is all mine. Bjorn, I want to start with you. And speaking of moss, it's also been said that a rolling stone doesn't gather any. I'm sure we've all heard the cliche. That certainly rings true with you. Your work history indicates, I don't know if restlessness is the right word, but Bjorn, if you look at Bjorn's LinkedIn page, this guy doesn't seem to stop. He's got multiple projects going on at any given time. His work history ranges from Roche to AbbVie to WuXi to a dozen or so startups. So I want to start sort of by getting my mind wrapped around what motivates you to do all that. What motivates you to maintain such a high level of activity in the biopharma space?
Yeah, that's a good question, Matt. And sometimes I'm asked that. Because the CV looks quite busy, of course. One reason is that I'm already an old chap, so things are accumulating, of course. But otherwise, it was not planned like that. But what came out at the end, which was good for me, is that I had the possibility to look in all aspects of product development. So from discovery over preclinical, clinical. You know, everything was there. Also, the business side I've been learning over the years of things. So that was very beneficial. It was not planned like that. It just turned out like that. The underlying motivation is a good question. And I was once asked it and I made some thinking about it afterwards. So then I was later able to answer that. When I was a teenager, I visited my grandma in the hospital, and she was in a two bedroom room at that time in the hospital, and because the doctors were busy with her, I was talking with the other person in the room, another elder lady, and she told me her story of a cancer patient, which was really moving me very much, and that was the time where I decided I want to do something for patients. So I didn't know how yet exactly. But sooner or later, it then turned out that I studied molecular biology and wanted to go become a scientist, you know.
Yeah.
But then, you know, it developed in the CV, the busy CV that I have now.
Yeah. I hear that. I've also heard that you're quite the adventurer, deep sea diving. And what mountain have you climbed a couple times? Everest?
Yeah, I was once one of the craziest one was around Annapurna in the Himalayas. But that's a long time ago. I was still young and fit.
Well, I'm glad you made it through those harrowing experiences. Andreas, you've been a scientist with Aleva since before it was Aleva. And that's been like sort of the core thread of your career, hasn't it? I mean, coming out of school, if I'm not mistaken, you might have done a little bit of academic work, and then you're pretty much plugged into the company that's become Aleva from the early days of the company, right?
Yeah, more or less. Well, as you say, it was a bit later than in school, but I was a biologist already, and I don't know, it might have to do with the fact that my father was an engineer, and studying biology, it was on the one hand fascinating, but on the other hand, I always was looking for something that is more near to developing, producing something for that the mankind can use. And in that search, I came across a company here in Freiburg and a professor having founded that company, which was at that time Green Ovation. And the purpose, the goal of the mission of the company was to develop a moss, that tiny little moss, into a pharmaceutical production system. And that really... that really got me. So I applied for a PhD, and to make long story short, I had the chance to do my PhD in conjunction with the company. That was back in 2000. And then years later, after having had insights and having co-developed a lot of the technology we have today, I had the chance to start here, and that was back in 2009. So. Yes. Yeah. Since then, I'm in the company, and I'm here developing moss.
This concept of developing moss into therapeutics has been core though from day one for you, Andreas. I mean, this has sort of been your bailiwick or the ten ring of your target from your academic days.
Yeah. Sure. I mean. For me it was the ideal combination of doing on the one hand science and research for new things, on the other hand was the goal to, well, the best a researcher can do to develop medicines and, you know, novel medicines for unserved diseases in patients. And that really got me and gets me today. That's what motivates me.
Cool. And we're going to get into the details here on the moss production angle. But I want to quickly transition to the business at Aleva. From what I understand, your business, your kind of go to market model is one part biopharma, right? Developing a pipeline and one part developing a bioprocess platform. And I mean, it occurs to me that with the approach that you're taking, that's probably a necessary approach, right? You've got to figure out how to move the platform forward, whether you're going to develop your own candidates or not. But tell us a little bit about that two-part sort of process. Which came first and why? What was sort of the approach there?
Yeah, shall I quickly? I believe you are hitting the nail on the head. So we have two things here that we are working on. The one are our own candidates that come out of the pipeline, and the other thing is the platform itself. Let's start with the platform. Andreas, of course, is obviously the expert. He can tell more details. But the thing is, the platform is now is now very robust. We have GMP and we have large volumes available. So we want to position Aleva as a potential strategic partner for pharma partners that want to develop their product with our technology, because our technology maybe can solve a problem they have seen before in their efforts. The other thing is our own pipeline. In the moment, two products that is, of course, important to show that our pipeline is doing the job by bringing such candidates into the clinic, and also to, of course, to have a value increase for the company itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Andreas, what would you say if I asked you about sort of the, I guess, novel, I'm not sure if novel is the word, but how unique, I guess, is the concept of starting with moss as a source material?
Well, I would definitely say it's absolutely unique. So, to our knowledge, we are the only company worldwide using moss, exploiting moss commercially for pharmaceutical purposes. The only company exploiting it in any way commercially. It is unique, and of course that was the driver to develop it. And I think it is part of the story why it came until here over several decades. So there are problems out in pharmaceutical manufacturing that today, up to today, couldn't be solved. So that has to do with details in biochemistry of the products that could be in relation to glycosylations and stuff like that. But there are products that cannot be made today. And what we do is developing a system for some of those. Of those, we believe that moss can solve the problem. And I think we have demonstrated quite a lot in that. As Björn said, we have scaled up the system and we have made products, and we can go into detail later with this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, let's stick with that thread. You just mentioned the problem. You know, you mentioned glycosylation is one example. If you're thinking about the problems in CHO cell production environments, you know, and you're thinking about companies that might be attractive for you to partner, for Aleva to partner with, who might be experiencing some of those CHO related production challenges. Give us a little more detail on that. I mean, I'm you know, Andreas and Bjorn, you guys both know I'm not a scientist, so I may not fully grasp the challenge that you lay out. But trust me, those among our audience will appreciate maybe some color on what this moss paradigm solves specifically compared to the CHO environment.
Yeah. Thanks for mentioning CHO, because I think that is the most important comparator, maybe HEC and CHO, so the mammalian cell systems. Mm-hmm. And this is, as I said, this is the product world we are at the same time we are in with moss. So it's not the world of bacteria and yeast that is for less complex mass proteins. But when it comes to complex proteins, of course, CHO is the gold standard. We all know that, especially producing antibodies, antibody formats for therapies. But there are problems out there. The first point is there are other proteins than antibodies or antibody-derived products. That might be human proteins that need to be produced recombinantly, blood proteins, and some of them are really large, complex. They might be repetitive. They might have problems to fold correctly under certain pH circumstances, things like that. So that is the one thing, or in a more general term, I would say, difficult to produce products. I think this is the term commonly used for the not easygoing CHO products. Mm-hmm. And besides that, there are, I mentioned before, glycosylation is a big issue. For some products, they just need glycans, N-glycans, and they're fine. No, doesn't really matter in detail. But for some products, glycosylation is really key. For example, if you think of replacement enzymes, so that is the current paradigm, they are taken up from the bloodstream once they are intravenously given. by means of glycan receptors, which bind and detect certain glycans. And of course, efficacy is absolutely tied to the correctness of those glycans. If they are not on the product is not taken up to its target cellular subcompartment. So what we can do in MOS is to really tailor those N glycans on any product. And this has to do with two things. The most important thing is MOS is genetically easy to manipulate, as easy, I would say, as a yeast or a bacterium. We use the same techniques, and it goes, speaking time, it goes in the same time scale as you would do it, for example, with yeast. It is a haploid organism, so we don't need any backcrossing or laboratory things, time-consuming things, so we directly have the effect of our genetic manipulation. And then having this in mind, you can imagine that it is straightforward to design a host strain for a certain product, which, for example, makes a certain glycosylation on the product. And we did this several times, and it works quite well. The other thing is that MOS, I mean, we said it before, because we compare it to CHO, but I want to stress this point. MOS is a higher plant. So it means it is on an evolutionary scale as highly developed as a mammalian cell, as a CHO cell, as a human cell. Meaning in turn, it has the machinery to do exactly the same quality of proteins. It had everything in place to do post-translational modifications like glycosylation, but all the others as well. It can fold complex proteins. And then with the genetic engineering option, we have a perfect system to really make better and tailor-made products for a certain disease in biochemical meanings.
Yeah, that's it's fascinating. Excuse me. I am bouncing around here a little bit. I want to pan out just a little bit. Like I want to pan out, and I want to get my mind wrapped around. You know, I opened the segment by chatting about the writer Elizabeth Gilbert, right, and her book and her quote about MOS, and I thought that's a beautiful illustration of the accessibility, right? Of and obviously there are all sorts of different type kinds. So I want to learn like what kind of MOS we're talking about specifically, but then I want to drill down into like what are you doing to procure this stuff? Like Elizabeth Gilbert says, I mean, this stuff grows everywhere in every environment, right? On every surface, it's extremely resilient. Obviously, to produce GMP grade material, you can't go out into the forest and grab a wad of moss off a rotting oak log. So take us, let's pan out here, Andreas, and take us through what's going on at Eleva to grow and on the upstream side, begin to create a product that you can work with.
Sure. So first of all, the moss, the specific moss we are working with is Physcomitrium patens, or it formerly known as Physcomitrella patens, but this is systematic stuff from other people who reclassified it. So its today's name is Physcomitrium patens. That has been collected some 60 or 100 years back by a biologist in UK who was describing mosses and for that purpose collected mosses. And since then it is in vitro culture used for scientific purposes. Then let's make a jump, not too much history, but at some point, of course, the idea came up as described before to use it. And at that time, the company already had, of course, this in vitro and clean source of this strain Physcomitrium patens. And what we did then is to develop everything a pharmaceutical production process needs. And one point we had in mind, and I'm very glad we did that at 10 or 20 years back, we had in mind of, okay, we have to fit into the existing facilities, into the existing clean rooms and into the existing processes that people manufacturing biologics know and that are proven by proven by regulatory agencies.
Yeah.
And so we did. And this is why today we have a very much comparable system to the CHO cell production. So we do basically the same things. We start, because you were asking for how do we secure the sources. We have master cell banks of our strains, of our blank strains, several of them, because they can do different things. And then we put a product gene in, but we take out of a cell bank source, which is stored in the gaseous phase of liquid nitrogen, as everybody manufacturing biologicals knows it. Mm-hmm. And starting from those master cell banks, we go the normal path. We then have a seed train expanding our seeding material, creating inoculum for the upstream process. With that, we inoculate our bioreactors, which are, by the way, standard out-of-the-shelf bioreactors from Sartorius. I have to give some credits at this point at Sartorius, because we talked a lot with Sartorius about our process. And of course, obviously, as we have a plant, we needed light.
Yeah.
But we didn't want to have exotic things like greenhouses or tubular systems nobody knows. We wanted to have the equipment everybody uses. And Sartorius gladly decided, well, then we equip one of our standard bioreactors, the Biostat STR, the single-use bioreactor, with LED light. And that's what they did. And that is what everybody can buy today from Sartorius, as we do. And with that, we do the upstream. And the rest is simple. The moss secretes the product into the medium. We separate moss and medium, harvest the medium, and from there we do a classical downstream by chromatographic methods.
It's pretty cool. I got to tell you, Andres. You know, for the benefit of our audience listening, this grow light outfitted bioreactor is pretty cool to look at. I don't remember. I saw it either on a page on your site or somewhere on Google, but you know, I don't know what it's like. I don't know if the underglow look is cool in Germany, like if young kids put the underglow lights on their cars and stuff, you know, like that's real cool here in the States, right? Well, that's what it reminded me of, this bioreactor. It's got this really neat glow about it. It looks like something in space. So it's very cool aesthetic.
Yeah, underglow is a very good marketing aspect. I didn't think about that.
Yeah, maybe you want to play that up. So the volume, I want to get a sense for the, well, you know, before I get to that, I had a question about the specific strain. You mentioned that the strain was collected 60, 100 years ago and refined. And was there a reason why that, I mean, of all the mosses that grow globally and all these, you know, different places, was there a reason why that strain, particular strain, lent itself to this science?
Yeah, I tried to make it short. At one time, way back, and I can't name it, I don't know about it exactly, but they realized, the scientists realized that this strain has a certain, or this moss has a certain genetic, which allows for, as I said, for quick engineering, and they use that for what is called reverse genetics. So they knocked out genes and then looked for the function of those genes in order to deduce things one could use for agroeconomy, for example. So that is the reason, in my mind, why it landed in the labs and why it became a standard organism in genetic agriculture research. And from there, again, it made its way, as described, into our hands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bjorn, I want to ask you to jump in here for a minute, because I'm just, as Andreas and I are sitting here talking about, you know, the moss paradigm and how unique it is, it occurs to me that you've spent the bulk of you call yourself an old chap, but you've been around the block a few times. You worked for some big companies. You spent the bulk of your career working for these big companies, and I'm not going to say they're not innovative. You know, that's not true. There's certainly incredibly innovative, but they're also probably pretty structurally traditional compared to this experience you're having at Aleva. And you know, from a source material standpoint, maybe a bit more traditional. So what in the world inspired you to say, you know what? Yeah, this MOS concept is something that I want to get behind as CEO and jump on.
Well, I believe what you said is the point that big pharma companies usually use technologies that are very well established, that are very robust, that everyone knows in detail, and where they cannot do anything wrong, right? Because they have a big risk if they do something wrong. You know, millions and millions of bucks are lost, and that's something they want to avoid, of course. What I found so fascinating about Eleva's technology, beside being exotic, which always attracts me, exotic stuff, but what I found now interesting is the time point where Eleva is with this technology. Now is the time where Eleva has established, as I said before, the process as very robust. They were able to increase the volumes. They are now working with 1,000 liter fermenters, and still there are plans to increase that further. And they have shown that what Andreas called difficult proteins, they were able to do that and bring them even into the clinic. So that is now for me the time point where it would make sense to go out to Big Pharma and talk with them and tell them, look, maybe you were not always able in the past to work with all your dream candidates because show system, for example, was not really giving you good yields or no yields at all for several reasons. Why don't you look at this new technology? Because now it is at the stage of maturity where I believe it's the right time point to bring it out and roll it out to Big Pharma. Mm. That was what I found so fascinating. And and in addition, then the two candidates which are there, which are serving, rare diseases. And that's something I believe, although in the last 10 years or so, the attention for rare diseases was getting better, but still, you know, there are many of those diseases where patients are still in high need, and that's something where I also wanted to involve myself. So this combination of technology that is now ripe for rolling out, and some candidates that are really extremely interesting to develop further, that was the trick. And then I met the team, and that completely got me then on the hook.
You mentioned, you use the word exotic. You know, that's certainly appealing, and I can see that. You know, I can see where the molecular biologist in you would be drawn to exotic. Yeah. But as CEO, as a businessman, you know, right, a lot of times we equate exotic with expensive. So share with us a bit about that if you can. I'm not sure how early days it is to maybe do some comparisons to mammalian cell approaches. But is this paradigm any cheaper yet? Will it be at some point? Like, give us some sense for how it kind of stacks up on the cost side.
Yeah, currently it's not cheaper than CHO. Cost-wise, it would land in a similar ballpark, plus minus. Mm-hmm. The goal is less to be competitive on the price side. If we are there, the same ballpark, we would feel comfortable. If we are a little bit cheaper, that's fine, of course. But we would see more the value for our potential partners in the fact that if they have a difficult protein, we might do the trick with our technology. I believe that's where we what to position it, the value of problem solving, so to speak, not so much competing on the price side.
When you're striving to excel in a new arena, the best guides are the ones already doing it well. The business of biotech brings those voices forward to help new and emerging biopharmas turn their innovations, like mRNA and cell and gene therapies, into clinical realities. Tune in and subscribe for insights on hiring, regulatory, and other need-to-know topics for biopharma leaders. The podcast is brought to you in collaboration with Cytiva. Check out their resources at cytiva.com/emergingbiotech. That's CYTIVA.com/emerging biotech. As far as like that complexity, the complexity is concerned, and the partners that might be a good fit, have you been able to, I don't know, identify or classify any specific sort of therapeutic areas or modality, therapeutic approaches that would be a more likely fit for you than others?
Well, that has two aspects. The first is looking at our two candidates, which are both rare diseases that are more in the nephrology area. Mm-hmm. So for those, of course, partners in the nephrology area or big pharmas that are active in this disease field are more likely to be interested. In general, however, looking at our technology, you can use it for any disease area. Doesn't matter whether it's oncology or anything else. There's no limitation for that. Only from our own two candidates, nephrology in the moment would be for these. If you want to license them out or partner the development, we would be looking into nephrology. Otherwise, no limitation.
Yeah. I want to point out too that, you know, when I first talked with you two a couple few weeks ago, I guess, we had a conversation and I was kind of skeptical, I guess, is an appropriate word, which as a journalist, I kind of try to be when I'm talking with companies who are developing a platform who want to market that platform to biopharmaceutical companies, because biopharma companies are our audience. And, you know, I don't intend for this to be this show to be commercial in any way, shape, or form, right? Like I'm not doing this, you know. So you'll recall when we chatted, I kind of took you down the line of questioning around your proprietary pipeline and tested maybe, right? Tested you on like how legitimate is this pipeline, or is it just sort of a front, if you will? It's legitimate. You've got your Fabry and Pompe candidates are both clinical stage. You've got another, so I want to talk about some of your pipeline projects. So you've got another line of projects in the pipeline that are preclinical. But tell us a little bit more about that. You've alluded to them, Bjorn, the Fabry and Pompe candidates. Mm-hmm. But tell us a little bit more about those candidates and where they stand.
All right. There are two candidates in the moment we are focusing on. Sorry. The one is alpha galactosidase, which has been developed and brought into the clinic, and has been a successful phase one behind its back. So that was very positive, and we are now looking for partners to pick it up. Mm-hmm. The second one, which is now our main focus, is factor H, also. A molecule that plays a role in immunological diseases and which nobody so far could produce recombinantly. So there are other therapies around with other products that are fishing in the same pond, so to speak, but those have certain disadvantages, which mainly lie in the fact that there are inhibitors, while our factor H is a regulator. You know, as an immunologist, I can tell you inhibiting some immunological pathway somewhere has always the risk that you shut more down than you want. And that's why you always try to turn on the regulator and try to turn it to normality, so to speak. And this is something where with factor H we are playing with. Because we want to normalize a certain immunological effect and not shut it completely down, which would open patients, for example, for infectious diseases. So that's why we believe that's a very important and interesting therapeutic approach. But as I said, until now, nobody was really able to produce it recombinantly in a way that it was doing the job it was supposed to do, at least not to our knowledge. So we have this product, Factor H, now at the brink of the clinic. Sorry, I have to take it.
Sure.
At the brink of the clinic.
It's like 3:40 in the afternoon in Germany. I'm assuming that was a warm beer that you just took a drink of.
Yeah. So, sorry. We want to bring it to the clinic now in the first half of next year. So we are currently working on the IND enabling package and preparing the clinical trial with that. So that's the two assets we have.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm interested in your thoughts, Bjorn, on a company such as yours that and it's not uncommon, right? It's not uncommon that we're seeing companies that are biopharmaceutical companies developing a pipeline, but also developing a platform for partnership purposes. It makes perfect sense, especially if you can do it well. And doing it well, I can see in a startup environment, you know, relatively small, agile team could be challenging. So can you share some, I guess, thoughts, reflections, advice on managing a company? And Andreas, I invite you to jump in on this one too, because you've been there for quite some time on the science side. Just thoughts on like where the big challenges lie in attempting to do what Eleva is attempting to do, and how to deal with those challenges.
Right. So, from my point of view, there are a couple of challenges that I believe the most biotech companies are facing. One is, of course, the fundraising and the financing problem. Most companies, and especially in these times now, most companies are really struggling with that. And as a CEO, usually your main job is constantly to run around and make sure that the company has enough water under the bow, right?
Yeah.
So this is extremely important, and at Eleva we have the luxury to have an investor that was very loyal. I've never seen that before. A very loyal investor who supported the company through good and bad times over really a very long time. I really appreciate that, and that's a luxury situation for Eleva a little bit. Another thing is this step from the science where you are working with your asset or your platform or both, from the science to really then product development. That's a step that is crucial in the life of a biotech company. And if you don't do it in a good way, well planned, and especially by collecting as much outsized knowledge and skills to support you, then you are in trouble, because usually the startup team is very science driven and not very skilled in the product development later, especially clinical development. So if you are not bringing these two things together in a good way, then you can really as a company struggle over years and maybe even go down because you don't do this process very well. So I believe these are the most important things. And what I can tell others in such situations, don't be shy to ask the outside world for help and support and knowledge. Get as much advice from the outside as you can get. It doesn't hurt and to ask, and it will always help you. Don't be shy. Don't be don't think you can do everything by your own.
Yeah. Yeah, Andreas, what are your thoughts on that? You're managing director and CSO, and as I said, you know, you came at it sort of from a prop. If I'm hearing you correctly, you came at it from sort of a platform development perspective, like how are we going to make this happen, and maybe along the way adopted, the mindset around, well, let's demonstrate the capabilities by developing some assets. What's been most challenging from your perspective?
Yeah. So, correct. As my role title says, I always was, and I'm still on the technology development side. And in this role, I had the great luck to really be part of the journey. I think every biotech company, if it has a chance to, goes from really small, from really lab scale, from really more academic ideas, maybe, all the way to something that can survive and is usable in an industrial or productive environment. And of course, there's a lot of challenges on this way. And well, I could name several of them, but I think one of the main learnings I had, and I'm still happy that I've learned that, is you need really the right choice of people. You need the right team, and there must be the right mixture of being really, really good scientists on the one hand, but at the same time, enthusiastic about what they do and be excited about this idea, which from their perspective in an early biotech is far future. And you need people that stick to the idea because they are enthusiastic. And this is absolutely the case here in this team. And of course, the rest then is always the balance between what is really special to your development, what is the things you need to solve yourself. And there are, of course, topics. Balance to what is more general and what can be better solved by help from outside, as Björn says. And yeah, we had both. We had very much, very good help always from outside. And now we are in this transition, as Björn described, from being ready with development for some point and then going out now with products into the clinical development world. And of course, this is a turning point of the company, and I'm very happy to see how still the same team now expands with internal and external expansions, help from outside to start the next part of the journey.
Yeah, I got a couple follow-up questions for you on that. First, we'll go with the recency approach. Help from the outside. Is it too early to say? Are you at liberty to say like what some of those sources of help might look like on the outside? Like, can we envision a situation where you're outsourcing to CDMO partners that have these awesome glow, the underglow bioreactors I referred to earlier? Or is it too early to say where you might go with that?
Yeah, that's a good, the underglow bioreactors and the CMOs is a good example. Earlier than that is, of course, the standard regulatory topics. So coming from a lab and transitioning a system into a pharmaceutical, you stumble across regulatory issues. And this is something you can get help from outside, talk to experts, involve them, and then bring it on the right way. But yeah, the bringing the underglow bioreactors, as you name them,
into like that term.
Yeah, and I like that. Yeah, the into a clean room, into a CMO environment. As a company at that time, being no more than 20 persons, so really a small biotech, you need to find CMO partners that are willing to talk to you, that are willing to talk about how could this happen, because it's a new constellation. They don't, at the starting point, they don't have this kind of underglow bioreactor, but they know it because it's a standard, but with underglow. So, I'm very glad we found several partners. It was really nice to see that, not the very large ones, but a mid-cap size of CMOs was willing, not only willing, but had fun talking to us and then drawing solutions. And there we are. We are working together with our CMO for almost a decade now. Yeah. Successfully produced several preclinical and clinical batches because they were supportive in a way, and of course, it was a benefit for them as well.
Yeah, are you at liberty to say who that CMO is, or is that you want to keep that one under your vest?
No, we can say that it is BB Tech, a German company called BB Tech, who's partnered with us to produce both clinical batches of the alpha galactosidase product, as well as now for the coming batches of clinical product for the factor H, for the immunological product.
For the record, if BB Tech, or I know we have listeners at Sartorius, if BB Tech or Sartorius want to talk with me about licensing or trademarking the word underglow bioreactor, just have your lawyers get in touch with my lawyers and we'll take that conversation offline. Andreas, you mentioned regulatory, so I want to pick your brains a little bit on that. What's been your experience in these early days with the regulatory bodies? Given that, you know, we're delving into some never before seen territory here. Has it been particularly challenging? Have you been, you know, openly and warmly embraced by perhaps the EMA and FDA and other regulators you're working with, or what's that experience been like?
Yeah. Thanks for asking. So in the end, I have to say we have been warmly embraced and welcomed by all the authorities. Of course, after they had certain questions, which is their job and which they have to ask, about measures we took, about a process in general, about the existence of a cell banking system. But once they had made their checks, which they could because it's all in place, and then even further, when we were talking about the safety and robustness of our system, which I didn't mention yet, the system is, in contrast to mammalian systems, extremely robust. So might have to do that it is not really a cellular system. It's not a cell culture, but it is a plant culture. It is mosses, which we have. And they are extremely... They tolerate extreme changes in, for example, pH, in temperature, without any effect on the products. Plus the fact that we have a plant system and we don't have, for that, and because we had an eye on it, we don't have any animal-derived components in the whole process, from strain development up to harvest of the product. No animal source product is in contact with the process. And for that, we have zero risk to have any pathogens, viruses, contaminating and potentially harmful substances in our products, which was positively perceived by all the regulatory authorities in a way that they were okay with leaving out virus testing and virus filtration for our process. So yes, regulatory authorities did ask questions, but we could answer them positively. And after that, they had made a check on the system, on the production platform, and then we were talking product, clinical development plans, like every other system as well.
Yeah. When the idea was getting off the ground, when the company was getting off the ground, the platform was sort of in its early development stages. Were you going into it eyes wide open to the points you just made around, like, boy, we'll really give ourselves some latitude and grace on the pH approach, and the temperature controls won't be as, you know, perhaps the temperature controls will be far more forgiving than in a mammalian system. You know, the pathogens and viruses risk that you mentioned, were those all driving factors in the pursuit of this platform, or were they sort of discovered along the way?
No, it was the first case. They were, the sum of them were driving factors to really pursue the development, and that is, in one point, it's reflected in the outcome, because if you want to make sure you have a process that is not, as I said, is not and was never in touch with human-sourced or animal-sourced material, then you have to start from your earliest strain development. If you imagine we're using strains that we developed 10 years back, but we still use them to insert a product, and then we really need to make sure that we have documentation that it never was in contact, because it's that strain, and of course the follow-up strains of the strain, which then finally produce. And all this was all discussed with FDA, for example, other authorities, and our documentation traces back to 10, 15 years ago, that it's like I described. So yes, we have that in mind. As some of several factors, the others I mentioned before, that could make a better system and could solve products for biologics production.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Bjorn, I want you to weigh in on this next question as well as Andreas. Andreas talked a little bit about some of the softer aspects of growing a business around people and expertise and enthusiasm and culture. And these are, you know, I often hesitate to ask too many questions about those soft skills because they're hard to quantify. They're hard to define. But obviously they're important because almost all of the executives I interview want to talk about, you know, those attributes. So I guess I'd put the question out there like this. Andreas, you started with good science. You said, you know, we need good scientists. And then you went from there to we need enthusiastic scientists who can sort of work enthusiastically towards the vision that is not right in front of them. There's a path to that. It's going to take time and hard work. So tell me first, what makes a good scientist? Is a good scientist someone who comes out of, you know, Penn or Albert Einstein with a PhD and a 4.0? Who, you know, checks all those boxes on a resume? Is that a good scientist? And if there's more to what makes a good scientist, what is it?
I believe that was to you, Andy, right?
Well, it's
either, okay. Good.
Whoever's got a strong opinion.
Yeah. All right. I believe a good scientist is a scientist, and Andy, you give your opinion as well. But from my perspective, a good scientist in the lab or in a team, in a development team, is somebody who is, and it sounds like a cliche, but it's true, who's able to think outside of the box, who is not following the beaten path, who is, when there is a problem, also searching advice from others, who is, I always say, two brains are better than one thinking about a problem. And that's true. I mean, it sounds basic and simple, but it's really, I believe, the most important thing that you are able to bring together a couple of people in solving a problem together. I believe that's very crucial for a successful scientific team, that you have these kind of people. I mean, there are good scientists that don't need to talk with others, but they will only be able to develop that much, right? So in a team together, that's the most important thing. So they need to be able to be a team player. That I believe that's better and most important for if I look at a person than an A from the school or something.
Mm. Andreas, what do you think? Anything you'd add to that?
Yeah, I'm exactly in line with Björn, and saying that it's not really easy to find at the same time. Mm-hmm. So maybe to summarize it, for me, a good scientist is an academic problem solver, and the problem solver part is the hard to find part, because academics and the way you're teached it, at least in Europe in academics, is often not problem solving, but it's problem oriented. It's problem finding, and that is what you don't come that you're not achieving with that attitude. But you need really to think you can solve problems by the things you know, and even more important, by the things your team and the academics, the scientists know. So you need to be a team player, as Björn said. And you need to be have a solving attitude.
Yeah. Yeah. And then the second part of that question I wanted to ask you about people is the enthusiasm part. You know, Andreas, you just said it's difficult to find, the difficult part to find is the problem solving part of that scientist equation. I would imagine that perhaps a long range enthusiastic view on the goal is also a difficult thing to find in science staff. Is that enthusiastic part difficult to source as well? And how is it trained? If so, like how do you instill that sort of enthusiasm in your science team?
So maybe I can take this as a first answer. I think it is in a way a sort of an automatic thing, because in an environment where a well-trained scientist can have jobs in the established pharma environment, being paid far better than in a starting biotechnology company, that already filters for people who go more for a vision than for earning a living. Of course, they can earn a living here, but you know what I mean? Yeah. And then this is normally a factor why they stay, by they're not attracted away by better offers, because they are able to see the midterm or even the long-term vision in what they are doing, and their personal perspective as well in what it could mean, not only for the check they earn, but as well for the journey they can be part of and the things they learn. Mm-hmm. And if this mindset is there, then you have very much of what you need as a perfect scientist, as a team member in a biotech like we are.
Let me chime in on that from a different perspective. So when I joined Eleva at the beginning of the year, I told you at the beginning that I was so fascinated and impressed by the loyalty of the investor. But on the other hand, the other side of the coin, the loyalty of the team and the energy that I've seen in the company. There are so many people in this team at Eleva that have been with the company for a really long time. And the retention is fantastic in this company. And that shows that, you know, the people, they believe in what they are doing. And the enthusiasm that you mentioned, that you were asking for, Matt, is really palpable in this company. So I was immediately enchanted by the energy that I could feel with the people there. And that was a very important part of my decision to join that team, because I really loved it. How they you know, glowed in the energy to work for this company. I really loved it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it is a unique proposition that I'm getting behind what Andreas is saying. Like you have an opportunity to come in as a scientist at a company like Eleva and establish yourself in a new, exciting, transformative area of therapeutic development. You know, not a lot of companies can hang their hat on that. Like, you know, we're just producing another standard therapy the same way that we've been doing it forever. It's maybe not as enticing to some of those young scientists. We're running short on time here. I've abused your time. I apologize. What haven't I asked you that I should have? Like what did I gloss over? What's important to the story that I skipped over too quickly?
I must have
done a fantastic job. You guys are hard pressed to come up with something that I skimmed over.
Yeah, no, I feel good. So I believe from my perspective, you touched the most important points. you know, the most important for us is that people understand that this technology is now really ready to go and to be rolled out. I believe that's the main point. We could touch that.
What is the next step in terms of the progression of the technology? Like, what's your big next step, Bjorn, as CEO at Eleva? Yeah. What's mission number one on your near term agenda?
Of course, to bring Factor H into the clinic and have successful a clinical phase 1-2 at the beginning. The second is that we really would love to get the interest of some larger partners for our technology to work with it. Because that's if we can convince one big player, you know, that would be an external valuation that is immensely important. The third thing is growing the team and keeping it happy while we do that.
Very nice. Very nice. Well, I've enjoyed learning about you guys and learning about Eleva. I appreciate you for coming on the show and subjecting yourselves to my rambling line of questioning.
Excellent. It was a pleasure to talk, Matt. So thank you for your time. And thanks for the opportunity.
Thanks, Matt. It was a pleasure.
You bet. Pleasure was all mine. We'll do it again sometime.
Excellent.
So that's Aleva's doctors Bjorn Koklovius and Andrea Schaff. I'm Matt Piller, and this is The Business of Biotech. We're produced by Bioprocess Online, part of the Life Science Connect community in partnership with Cytiva. Learn about Cytiva's commitment to new and emerging biopharma innovators at cytiva.com/emerging biotech. Then head over to bioprocessonline.com/BOB, where I invite you to subscribe to our exclusive newsletter for Business of Biotech listeners. We'll drop a new episode Monday morning like we always do. And in the meantime, I thank you for listening.